Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
Hello, everyone. Kevin Cruz here. Welcome to the weekly show. And this week, we're going to break our normal format. We're not going to do Q&A. We've got an interview that is really special, and it runs just a little bit longer than we usually do. So I thought I'd give it to you today. Our guest today, he's a true legend in the field of HR and leadership. He's repeatedly been named to the very prestigious Top 50 Thought Leader list. Now, I invited him on to talk about his new book, but you'll hear we end up hitting on a lot of topics, and he reverses it and asks me questions, which our guests don't usually do, so I go off on tangents. And it's pretty funny. He says some provocative things about TED Talks, about performance reviews, and just it was a really fun interview, so I wanted to bring that to you today. Now, before I introduce him, big thank you. You know, we've only been around for about 5 months. We're getting over 100,000 downloads a month now, which is a big podcaster milestone. And it's because you're telling your colleagues at work that the LeadX Show will help them to stand out and get ahead. You're telling your friends that the LeadX Show is the smartest way to start your day. And you keep coming back 5 days a week because you want to achieve your full potential. Thanks for investing your time with me, and thanks for helping us to build the LeadX tribe. And I've got a special favor to ask this week. This is brand new. I want you to ask me a question. Ask me anything. Now, I get asked a lot about leadership, productivity, entrepreneurship, how to be a writer, speaker dude. You can really ask me anything. But I want you to go to leadx.org/askkevin. And there's a little button. You're going to click it and you're going to speak your question out loud. And when you click that button, you know, the microphone on your phone or computer is just going to record you and it's going to automatically send me your question. So, you know, just a simple one or two sentence question for me. You'll see instructions on that page, leadx.org/askkevin. And if I play your question on the air on a future weekly show, I'll make sure that we send you, you know, a cool t-shirt or mug or autograph book or some kind of cool swag. And I'll owe you a lot of favors. So hit me with any question you got. Go to leadx.org/askkevin. All right, on to this week's show. Our guest today is considered by many to be the father of modern human resources. He's the Rentsis Likert Professor at the Ross School of Business, University of Michigan, and a partner at the RBL Group, which is a consulting firm focused on helping organizations and leaders deliver true value. He's the recipient of many awards, including a Lifetime Achievement Award from the ASTD, which of course is now known as ATD, and he's been repeatedly named to the Thinkers 50 list of top thought leaders. His new book is Victory Through Organization, Why the War for Talent is Failing Your Company and What You Can Do About It. Our guest is Dr. Dave Ulrich. Dave, welcome to the show.
Kevin, what a delight to be with you. Thank you.
I'm really looking forward to this, and we're going to talk about your new book in just a minute, but I always start out by asking our guests to tell us a story, and I'm hoping you'll tell us a story of a time when you actually failed, you know, maybe early in your career, because we want to hear what lessons you got from it.
Well, let's go early in my career. I'm on my way to law school, kind of a growing up fantasy without a lot of substance, but it sounded cool to be a lawyer. Majoring in English so that I can learn how to write a little better, because I figure that's what attorneys do. And I decide for my honors thesis to do a study of the English department. So I did a benchmark, and I didn't know how to do great studies of a department, but I benchmark against other great departments. I survey graduates. I do all kinds of research as a young undergraduate student and prepare a presentation. And I find out the department I'm in is not very good. It's not rated well by alumni. It doesn't lead to jobs. It doesn't match on the top 10 English departments in the United States where I was benchmarking. And so I do a presentation to the faculty. And I started the presentation. I remember, I feel like Beowulf going before the cruel monster. And I do my presentation. The chairman calls me in the next day and says, Dave, you're going to graduate with honors. You've got all your thesis. It's done. Thank you. You did great research. But we voted after you left that you should not have an English major. And they threw me out of the department. I went back to my advisor, who was a professor of organizational behavior, and he just laughed, and he said, you need to come into organizational behavior. You need to study OB. And I said, why? And he said, because we fail all the time. We tilt windmills. And I called my parents, and I said, I'm going to leave law school, and I'm going to study OB. And they were so excited. They said, oh, our son, the obstetrician, he's going to be a doctor. And I said, no, it's called, Mom and Dad, it's organizational behavior. And this was decades ago. And they said, what's that? And I said, I have no clue, but it fascinates me. So I owe my success to having gotten kicked out of the English department.
It sounds like maybe that was also an early lesson about being a consultant, because you got to be careful with delivering the truth.
I could tell you so many stories. Soon after, I'm doing my PhD, and then we'll get on to the topic at hand. And no, I made money. I mean, we're living on cans of tuna fish. And so teaching part-time at a university, the president calls me, and he says, I need you to consult for me. And I say, okay, small university, 1,000 students. And he says, my team isn't productive. They don't listen to me. Can you help? And I said, oh, I'd be delighted. I'm a young, vibrant PhD student. So I said, let me observe you and your team. Team meeting, he raises a question about something. I don't remember what it is now, student tuition or something. What do you think? He picks up the paper, starts to read it. And then he puts a paper down after a discussion. He says, I think we should do this. And everybody agrees. And he does it again. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm going to become the world's greatest consultant. So I go in afterwards and I say, you know, President, with all due respect, you are part of the problem. Your behavior is not accomplishing the right stuff. And he slams the table and he said, you're fired. The last two guys told me the same thing. Get out of my office. And I went home. And back then there was a sign, we'll consult for food. And it was a real issue. And I told my wife, man, my consulting career is not going to go very well here. So, yeah, I have learned. So, Kevin, you may not have had the time. What's one of your experiences?
Oh, my gosh, Dave, again, like I think I'm failing every day and in all kinds of work like that. And similar, you know, in those veins early on, I mean, I started my first corporate training companies when I was in my 20s. And I often say I was young and dumb. Not that everybody in their 20s is, but I was. And similar things where I'm not I'm a driver, I'm analytical. So I would just look at the world as black and white. I would lay the facts and the recommendations on the table. And I think the worst failure of that was one pharmaceutical company client. Our project manager on their side was not doing a good job. He was young also. And he threw me under the bus for a bunch of work that he missed, that he was were his mistakes. And he CC'd, you know, his boss and his boss's boss. I mean, practically the CEO. And instead of understanding why he was doing it and working with him and looking at the big picture, I hit reply all, countered his arguments, and attached files that showed that he had missed the deadlines, asked us to do unethical things, all this stuff. Well, I got a phone call about 30 minutes after that from his boss saying, listen, you might not be wrong, but you'll never work here again. And literally it was a large six-figure account and I lost just because of my own pride, my own ego. You know, I wasn't going to let him do that to me, you know, in front of those other executives. And there was obviously a much better way I could have handled it.
You know, we should start a magazine called Consulting Failure. and then change your line was young and dumb. It could be dumb and once young.
Yeah, right.
We're still dumb and we were once young.
We still fail.
But anyway, you went deep. I could go to last week and probably find some more. I think, you know, one of the things that is prevalent in the leadership field, and this may be a transition for you as well, is growth mindset, learning.
That's right.
It's a great concept from Carol Dweck and others. It's learning agility, the Lominger Group. But learning means failure is an opportunity to learn. And if we're not failing, we're not learning. And so I continually push my boundaries. When I teach, I don't always say it, but I often think it, I'm going to teach 120% today of what I know. And you'll probably be able to figure out the 20%. But if I'm not pushing myself, and the other line I have for myself, you started with this, I need to have 20 to 25% new material every 2 years. Now, you're not as old as I am, but people go, well, that's not a big deal. Holy smokes. Over a 30-year career, 40-year career, that becomes a big deal. And if I look at my slides, PowerPoints are a simple metric. I've got a 50-point pitch. Every 2 years, I've got to have 15 new slides. That sounds easy. It's not. And to get new slides, you got to kind of create stuff. And it's kind of first batch of cookies don't always taste very good. And the first few times I create, they aren't very good. Anyway, I'm in the middle of that right now. I've got some ideas that are out there that are pushing the field. And in fact, I'll give one more anecdote and then turn it back to you. I was invited a year ago to the Academy of Management. It's on right now. It's the leading management association in the world of professors around what do you do? Because I don't have a more traditional academic career. And I introduced myself. Elephants eat grass. And everybody said, what? This is a professor. They process grass and they pass grass. Many of the professors I know, not most, many, study the grass the elephants have passed. And there was dead silence. And they said, what did you say? And I said, wear gloves. What I want to do is I want to plant the grass the elephants will eat next year. And when you're in the model of planting grass, you're always exploring what's next. And that's for me the process of learning and failing. It's experimenting. It's testing. It's trying. Can I push myself to get a question nobody has an answer to? Plant the grass somebody will eat next year. And that's, for me, that's the delight of this field, is we get to find ideas that will have impact in a very new way.
Well,
end of soliloquy.
No, but Dave, this is great. We're going to end up riffing back and forth, all day on this. What I think of, and this is relevant for really anybody that does, public speaking, presentations, or just trying to develop their craft. What you said, it reminds me of, I'm always fascinated by stand-up comics of all people. And I'm not funny, and I would never have the courage to go up and try to do stand-up comedy. But, when it comes to this idea of failure, when you read the autobiography of Steve Martin, for example, or how Louis C.K., a more modern comic, does their work, they talk about walking up onto the stage of some little dive bar in Manhattan with a stack of note cards, and they're reading jokes, and they're looking at, okay, I just read 10 jokes. Only one got people to chuckle. The other 9 I'm throwing out. But it's this constant process of every year they need new material, whether they're going on the road, whether they've got a podcast or a TV show, they always need new material. And comedians are just funny. They just write jokes and it works. They write joke after joke and they try them out. And this is what I think of when you talk about that. I'm the same way. Every year it's like, okay, well, how do I stay current? How do I stay relevant? How do I stay fresh for people who already saw me at this event last year? And it's not easy.
Boy, we could rip on this, like you said. And it scares me to death right now because we're being socialized to think a good presenter is a TED Talk.
Yeah.
And a good presentation is not a TED Talk. That's a scripted 12 to 15 minute, canned soliloquy. I mean, it's a sonnet. It's a play on Broad Street that gets played every night. I think a good presenter is not a TED Talk. It's somebody who doesn't look polished, who's stumbling a little bit, as I've done just now, but who keeps creating new stuff, who's not saying, here's an answer, I hope it works for you, who's saying, let me get inside your head. What are you wrestling with? What's your problem? What are the challenges you face? Let's then co-create a solution that nobody's ever seen before. It's not sound bites of TED Talks. It's the creation of a set of ideas that will solve a set of problems you don't even fully understand yet. That, for me, is what presentation is. That's what good leadership is, I think. I think leadership is not about solving problems people have solved. It's about identifying and recognizing problems and challenges people don't even know they have yet.
That's right. That's right. I totally agree.
Having said that, I'll never get invited to do a TED Talk.
Let's pivot, because I want to make sure we do talk a little bit about your brand new book, Victory Through Organization. And, in it, you argue, and this is for many, especially in the human resources profession, you argue that, we should pivot from fighting the war for talent, quote unquote, to creating victory through organization. How do we make sure that the value we offer in an organization isn't just the sum of the individual pieces? And for me, again, I grew up in the HR field. I mean, war for talent, big McKinsey white paper, and a term that you hear over and over again. And you're saying, that might be holding us back a little bit. So tell me more.
Yeah, it's a great concept. So you got to have good people. And I love the term you used twice, pivot. It isn't shifting. A pivot means you keep A while you still do B, while you still do C. So we collected data, and I'll do the research and then we'll do the stories. And we have data from 1,200 businesses around the world and 32,000 people. And so the 32,000 people have talent. They have skills. We measure their skill set. We actually measure skill sets of 4,000 people from other assessments. But so we have data around individual skills. So if you hold up a left hand with five fingers, you got five individual skills. The right hand is a fist. It's the ability of the organization, 1,200 business units, to build the right set of capabilities to work well. So you got a question. On the left hand, you got five fingers. On the right hand, you got a fist. We have an outcome variable. And the outcome is business performance on a six-item scale. Which counts most? Is it the left hand with the five fingers, or is it the right hand with the closed fist? Does an individual matter more to business performance, or does the collective team? Is it the workforce, or is it the workplace? Now, the beauty of big data is I love statistics. My PhD is basically in statistics, numerical taxonomy, to bore you to death. So we did statistics. And I love going to groups and saying, which one matters more? Your left hand or your right hand, the fingers or the fist, the people or the process, and divide 10 points. And here's what we found. 4-1, 80-20, 10 points, organization. Now you go, whoa. Now remember, your term was pivot. That doesn't mean you can take really stupid people and create right. A great sports team. I mean, maybe you and I and three other people could still probably not beat very many basketball teams. I don't know your athletic ability, but I do know mine.
It's not great.
Even with a great coach. But we do see in sports, in soccer, 80% of the time, 20% of the time, the leading scorer in the World Cup is on the team that wins the World Cup. 20% of the time, the leading scorer in the NBA is on the team that wins the championship. 20% of the time, the winner of the Academy Award for Best Actor, Best Actress is in the movie that wins the Movie of the Year. There seems to be a pattern here that it's not the individual, it's how that individual works together with others to build the right organization. Talent matters, but organization matters more.
So the natural follow-up is, how can we take our hopefully talented individual players on our team and create that synergy, get that organization that's performing better?
Well, first, I think you have to have a base of decent talent. I mean, we have to have a base of people who can. Somebody did a great book on time management and productivity, and you need to be able to read that. That was a pitch for your book. Nobody got it. But you got to be able to have good people who have base skills and have learning skills. And then you got to say, number one, organization is not structure. It's not morphology and shape and roles and rules. It's capability. It's what we come together and be good at doing. Google is very good at analytics. Marriott is very good at service. Disney is good at guest experience. Apple is very good at innovation, and we could keep going. So you start by saying, what is the right capability or culture we need? In the field today, everybody's gaga over culture, and it's a critical thing. It was the word of the year a year or two ago in Webster's dictionary. But it's not culture. It's the right culture. And the right culture is the identity of the firm in the mind of our key customers. In other words, if I'm a manager, I want to say, what culture do I need for my business? It could be an enterprise or it could be a function. What is it my function or my business needs to be known for by those who will use my services? What's that brand outside that I translate inside? Getting that identity right becomes a key. And then the next step is building internal management actions that drive that culture. And it's, again, at a high level, this is pretty simple to say. It's not easy to do. But do we communicate that culture? Do we share it? Do we empower people to act on it? Do we hire, train, develop people? But at the heart of building that organizational identity or the right culture is leadership behavior. Do I, as a leader and as the leadership team I work with, really behave consistently with customer promises? One of the things we found is once you figure out what you want to be known for as a company in the marketplace, and it could be the customer marketplace, the investor marketplace, we've got to build leadership against that criteria. Final example, almost every company we've seen, big companies today, have competency models. Here's what we want our leaders to know and right. do. Well, my question is it the right competency model? I did work decades ago, and you're too young to remember it, but it's a simple example. It's an old example. You started by getting me back in my history, and senility may have stepped in, but Ronald Reagan fired all the air traffic controllers.
I remember.
You and I have 10 years left of our memory, and then it's gone. So I got hired to rebuild that system. It was one of my early consulting projects where I don't think I failed that time. There's a lot of stories with that, but we start rehiring, or they start rehiring, and they're not doing well. And suddenly we look at their sourcing practice, and they're going to universities. Well, one of the things you discover is, what is it we want an air traffic controller to be known for? It's not innovation. It's not creativity. It's discipline. It's standardization. It's diligence. It's operational excellence. Well, in fact, you don't want to know, can my air traffic controller land a plane looking in a mirror between his or her legs? I mean, no, right. I don't care. So we start changing the sourcing process. You go to military units, you go to police forces, you go to firemen, you go to accountants, you go to folks whose training and predisposition is discipline and operational rigor. And suddenly the success rate of transition into full-time hiring goes way up. Such a simple idea. But we don't do that. Most folks aren't building cultural statements against customers. We're not building leadership competencies against customers, nor are we building our HR practices against customers. We call that HR outside in. It was our previous book. Mm-hmm. In this book on victory through organization, you got to build the right organization against the promises you make your customers.
I'm taking notes like crazy. This is really, really great stuff. And you're talking, you mentioned sort of the, you know, my words, you know, what's the brand promise? What's your brand in the eyes, in the mind of your customers? And that made me remember in a recent article, you said, you know, when HR gets a seat at the table, you know, in the C-suite, among other things, they should ask, and this is, you wrote, to what extent do we have branded leaders who deliver results in the right way? That's one of the questions that HR can bring to the table. And what fascinated me about this statement, I want to know, what do you mean by branded leaders? To what extent do we have branded leaders who deliver results in the right way?
Again, I'm going to be a bit of a curmudgeon. I think often in leadership, we look at the action, not the outcome. For example, people say, I want leaders to be authentic. Well, who's going to disagree? You want leaders to be inauthentic? Of course, authenticity is good. But leadership authenticity in the absence of adding value to someone else is narcissism. This is a risky hypothetical, but you might have a leader who is very authentic, who shares what he thinks every morning, may even tweet what he thinks every morning to a broad audience of followers, very authentic about what he says and what he does. But unless that leader is creating value for someone else, that's narcissism. Leaders is not about authenticity in the absence of helping somebody else be better. And so that's the issue around outside in and brand. What a leader wants to do is not just to have a personal set of behaviors, but to turn those behaviors into a brand that helps other people get better. And so it isn't what I do, it's what somebody gets from what I do. It isn't that I communicate, it's that I communicate so that somebody's better because of the communication work that I do. And what we have found is there's a line of sight in the branding world between a product. You start with that. I'm a customer, I buy a product. You talk about pharmaceuticals, where you had some opportunities learn. They have a product, but beneath that, they want to become known as a firm brand. Pfizer says, I want to be not just have a great product, but a creator of a whole bunch of products. Underneath that firm brand then should be our culture. That creator of multiple products in the marketplace, that pipeline, means a culture of innovation. That culture of innovation, or that cultural brand, firm brand, should then lead to a leadership brand. I need leaders who ask questions, who probe ideas, who are creative. That then should lead to an employee brand. This is then my employee value proposition. It's what I should know and do as an employee. And so we see a line of sight between product, firm, culture, leader, and employee, and the brand theme being the integrating mechanism.
Love it. And I'm going to ask you to break it down. Well, I don't even know that it's breaking it down. That line of sight, you know, we're talking all about ideal organizational design to drive value. What would be some simple advice you would give a first-time manager who maybe, you know, doesn't have isn't getting strong training or support from her company? With all the research you've done and just your own life experiences, what would be a piece of advice you'd give a young manager?
You know, it's interesting. I've had the privilege of coaching, as have you, people from the CEO suite to first line supervisors. And I sat back. I think there's four questions I ask, and they're really simple. Question one, what do I want? So as a manager, what do you want? What is meaningful to you? What's success for you? Is it money? Is it fame? Is it impact? And what is it in your life that you want? What is your passion? What is your skill set? What is your purpose? Number two, who do I serve? Because again, the value of what you want is insufficient if you're not getting some other people to be better. So who are my stakeholders? Who am I trying to help? I'm a young manager. I'm trying to help my boss. I'm trying to help my peers. I'm trying to help my employees. I'm trying to help my company. Who is it that will benefit because of my work? Number three, how do I build? How do I then as a young manager create my identity? That's who I am. That's number one. My brand, that's who I serve. Number two. Number three, how do I create an organization? How do I build something so that it outlasts me? And successful leadership is not what you do, it's what you leave behind. And finally, number four is where am I on my journey? Where am I? What am I doing that works? What am I doing that fails? I love your first question. What am I learning from my mistakes? What am I learning from my failures? Where am I relative to that? So my four kind of generic coaching questions, what do I want? Who do I serve? How do I build? And where am I? And those would be some questions I would encourage not only a young manager, I think even more senior middle managers and more seasoned executives constantly should be reinventing themselves by those four questions.
Right. Goes back to some of what we started with. These are great questions. These are critical questions when you're just starting out, and then powerful to keep asking them over and over throughout our career, because the answers will change. The answers have to change.
Yeah, I think you and I are both perhaps old enough to know what I want is different than what I wanted 20 years ago. My goal is to have an impact, to help people think differently, to see their world in a way that empowers them to make more informed choices. Well, that's useful. That's what I want. How do I then get that out? How do I build systems to distribute that? And where am I on the journey? Am I pushing myself? Am I learning as I go? So what would you say? What would your tips be? I mean, you often sit on the other side of this microphone and you have the privilege of listening, but you distilled brilliantly. So what would you say?
Well, I think when I think about how poorly I performed as a young manager, there would be so many pieces of advice I would hope to give. I mean, I think this is just from my own personal experience. I am very non-confrontational. I'm an introvert, and I am very reluctant to give direct, honest feedback. Now, I learned how to do it, and things have gotten better. It's still not natural for me, but early on, I think if you are avoiding giving that direct feedback to someone, you will not be successful as a leader. I think that the coaching element of what leaders do, I think the coaching element helping other people to grow. And, you know, Dave, I think I almost changed my behavior instantly when I saw some research from Gallup, and I don't have the exact data. The numbers are going to be a little bit off here, but it said something like, you know, people who get only positive feedback from their boss, like 66% of those people were engaged at work. And then the people who got feedback, but it was only negative, I'm only telling you what you're doing wrong all the time. Well, those people were like 50% engaged. And we know Gallup numbers that it's only about 1 out of 3 that are engaged in North America. So what's missing? And the third question was, I get no feedback from my boss. That group was, again, like 10% engaged. And I really understood that this is getting, you know, into the psychology of it, but I'm projecting like, oh, it feels awful to receive this feedback and get course corrected and all the rest. Well, that's not true. It's a gift. You know, I was holding back because I thought I was being mean, or I was hurting someone, or they might fight me on it. What I was withholding was a gift, because we all need to and want to get better. We want a boss, a coach, who's going to tell us, hey, great job doing this. Keep doing more of that. And hey, here's where, you know, there's a gap. You need to up your game in this level. We all need those coaches. And I was really failing early on. So that's kind of, I mean, believe me, there's a lot of advice out there. But that for myself was a big lesson I learned too late in life.
Well, I can relate to that. I too am an introvert. And I was wondering, why are we not doing a video? And now I know why. Neither of us want to be on camera. But there was an old test. Today you have Myers-Briggs and you have DISC, but it was called FIBRO-B. And one thing I liked about FIBRO-B, it was what do you give and what you receive. So the only thing that you started with and then you ended different is not only do you have to learn to give feedback, you've got to also learn to be a recipient and receive the feedback.
Yeah.
And you said that well in your response. So a good leader gives feedback, but part of the giving feedback is modeling receiving feedback. And so a leader in a performance appraisal says, look, I have some things I need to tell you that will help you do your job better, but let me start. What is it I need to do as a leader so I can improve? And then the leader models that and says, you know, thank you. Those are the things I need to look at. And then in the same spirit can help the employee begin to improve his or her performance. I really like that.
Love it.
Very nicely done. In fact, in the HR field, and a quick aside, in the HR field, there's a big movement now to do away with performance appraisal. I think that is so dumb. Absent accountability, people don't perform well. Almost nobody washes their rent-a-car before they turn it in.
Right, right.
We do fill it up with gas. What we've got to do is we've got to have positive performance accountability. That doesn't mean you do paperwork. It means you have positive conversations. And that's one of the issues where I see that getting played out. Nicely said, Kevin. Thanks.
Well, and here we go riffing on it. My issue with performance reviews are when they're annual and there's no other feedback, you know, in the other 11 months. It's like, let's save it up for December and now go through this strange form of where I grade you on, you know, a 5-point scale. And so my fear is if we do away with performance appraisals, then there's going to be no feedback whatsoever. But if we could get into that pattern of quarterly, every 6 month, every day coaching, then hopefully we don't need to rely on that annual review as much. So,
can you imagine toilet training a child with an annual review?
Dave, I'm going to steal that and use it in my next talk. So one last question before we wrap up. I always challenge our listeners to become just a little bit better every single day. So I'm hoping you'll challenge us. Just, you know, what's one specific thing? It can be from your new book or just from anywhere. What's one thing you want us to do today that'll make us a little bit better?
My personal brand and identity is learn. So what did I do yesterday that didn't go so well? What do I learn from it? Run into it. Don't run away from it. We love to run and hide. Run into it. What did I do? What could I do better? And how can I apply that today?
Love it. Great challenge. Tell our listeners, Dave, how can they find out more about you, your work, your books?
We have a website called RBL, stands for Results-Based Leadership, rbl.net. Might be the easiest. Or I'm getting active on LinkedIn. I'm learning how to do that. And my email. I'm very responsive to email. It's my initials, D-O-U. At UMich, UMich.edu, University of Michigan, DOU at UMich.edu.
And listeners, we'll put all of this information and links right in the show notes so you have them handy. Dave, incredible conversation. Thanks for joining us today.
Kevin, anytime. And thanks for your good work. You're clearly having ideas with impact and shaping lives people live, which is congratulations on what you do.
That means a lot coming from you, Dave. Thanks for that. LeadX family, don't forget, you can get links and notes from this interview over at leadx.org. And you can also download our free ebook, Richard Branson's 7 Secrets to Leadership, at leadx.org/Branson. And if you want to get more LeadX in your everyday life, just follow us at LeadX Life on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. That's one word, LeadX Life. And if you've ever gotten even just one good idea from a LeadX show, do me a huge favor. It takes less than a minute. And just subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave a quick rating. Just go to leadx.org/subscribe. Until next time, friends, remember, leadership is about influence, which means we are all leaders. Whether you're a salesperson or a soldier, an entrepreneur or an executive, a coach or a counselor, you are leading all of the time. You positively influence with your behavior, and you influence negatively when you're a bystander. How will you lead today?